Welcome to the 8 Billion Project, where we're on a mission to make an impact by discovering and sharing the purpose of every person on this planet. I'm your host, Lisa Florida. Enjoy today's episode. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the 8 Billion Podcast. I am your host, Lisa Florida, and today I've got a very special guest. I have Jeffrey Deskovic. Jeffrey Deskovic is ESQ, is an internationally recognized expert on wrongful convictions and the founder of the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice, which has freed 11 wrongfully convicted people and helped pass 3 laws. Jeff is also an advisory board member of the coalition group, It Could Happen to You, sits on the Global Advisory Council of Restorative Justice International, and is a co-owner of the Recharge Beyond the Bars Reentry Game, which facilitates the formerly incarcerated reconnecting them with their friends and family. Jeff does presentations across the country and internationally, and also does motivational speaking. His motivation is that he spent 16 years in the prison from age 17 to 32 for murder and rape prior to being exonerated by DNA. A documentary short about his advocacy and his life post-exoneration called Conviction is currently available on Amazon Prime. Welcome, Jeffrey Deskovic, to the 8 Billion Podcast. It is such an honor to have you on this platform. Thank you for being here today. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm really looking forward to today. Such a warm personality. This is going to be a wonderful interview, I have no doubt.
No, thank you so much. You have such an amazing personality too. After everything, I've done so much research on your story. And thank you so much for reaching out to the 8 Billion Podcast. This is, like I told you, I can't begin to say enough that this is such an honor. I just finished watching your short documentary on Amazon. And so I'd like to touch on that first. So could you share with me, maybe before touching on that, would you like to give maybe, other than the bio, is there anything that you'd like to add first before we go into the whole documentary?
Maybe I'll just mention that, you know, my mission in life, the way I make sense of everything that happened to me, my mission in life is to free other people who are wrongfully imprisoned in the same position that I was once in, and to do some work on the preventative side while also pushing the general criminal justice reform. And so really that's how I have my sense of inner peace. I have my mission in life. That's how I interpret everything. It's how I keep my sanity. And, you know, it's 50, 60 hours a week doing advocacy work. So maybe that's a great tee up for everything that'll flow from today's interview.
No, absolutely. I mean, another, you know, before we walk in or go into the whole documentary too on Amazon, you know, I was reading articles and I read that one on social entrepreneurship. And I'm a huge advocate of social entrepreneurship. So like everything completely matched up. And it's so noble, everything that you've been doing in life. And so anyways, let's go into the documentary. Could you share exactly why you wanted to do or put out this documentary on Amazon?
Sure. So I agreed to be in Conviction, which was directed and produced by Gia Wirtz, because I wanted to bring more attention to the problem of wrongful conviction, and also my organization, and also increase my own profile as well, all for the purpose of, you know, being a more effective, even more effective tool in the struggle. But beyond that, the main thing I was trying to accomplish while being filmed, because I mean, I like to kind of think fast on my feet. You know, when that happens, you can maximize the moment opportunity. So I was trying to carry some water for some of the non-innocence justice reform issues. So in other words, the fact that the documentary is about me automatically means that wrongful conviction will get some attention because it's about me. But why not use that moment to also shed attention to a lot of very disturbing things that I saw while I was wrongfully incarcerated. So in Conviction, I brought attention, for example, the need for prison reform, you know, the verbal abuse that used to go on with the guards, or we talk about, you know, the amount of prisoner on prisoner violence and how there seems to be very little motivation on or effort on the part of the authorities really to reduce, if not eliminate that. And I discuss, you know, terrible medical care in prison and elderly people in prison and how the prison really isn't equipped to deal with the advanced medical needs of elderly people. And how tied into that, you know, many of the guys who are older have been in 10, 20, 30 years, some of them living in honor block, some serving as role models, and totally different people from who they were 10, 20, 30 years ago when they did do a crime. Many of them having bachelor's degrees or completing other vocational trades, therapeutic programs, very good disciplinary records, and yet they would go to the parole board and they would get turned down just based on what the original charge was. And that really is something that will never change. There's no changing the original charge. So it really should be about rehabilitation and, you know, and denying parole based only on the charge, how that, you know, is a complete abandonment of the idea of rehabilitation. And then also, when people were terminally ill and they could put application in to be released early prior to their sentence being finished, you know, just to die with some dignity, you know, in with their family and while free, and how often by the time the authorities made that decision, either they pass away already, and I saw that happen, or, you know, they pass after a day or two, the decision comes, they release their home for a day or two, and, you know, and that's it. You know, the absence of college education for prisoners. I mean, college education, such a serious crime-fighting tool. Nationally, there's a 68% recidivism rate. But when you look at Hudson Link, for example, which is a nonprofit organization that brings college education to prisoners, only a 2% recidivism rate. So I saw how college education transformed people. They went from talking about war stories of when they were running the streets and chasing money through illegal means. Conversations went from that to they were talking instead, dreaming out loud, being a drug counselor or diverting at-risk youth from, you know, ending up in prison like they did. And I personally benefited from college education in prisons, mm-hmm. because when I was released at Maine, I had gotten the associates and I completed additional study towards the bachelor's degree. I only had 10 classes left. So I had that much ground left to cover upon release to get the bachelor's degree. So, you know, so I talked about, you know, all of those things and prisoner reentry, and I was just, it's maddening. It was maddening to me just to see the amount of injustice around the board that goes on. And I just how I expect more. I expect more from, you know, United States, you know, with the eloquent words and the Constitution, mm-hmm. a state constitution. But as a country, we don't live up to that. You know, so I was trying to shed light on all of those disturbing things, because the whole key principle is this, is that people are sent to prison as punishment, meaning you lost your freedom. You did something wrong. Now you have to pay for that. So you lose your freedom for however long it judge determines. You're not sent to prison in order to be punished. You're not sent to prison in order to be mistreated. Punishment is loss of freedom, not to be mistreated. And even in the punishment, I saw people who were over sentenced. There were people that had, you know, had gotten caught with a certain possession of drugs, and how some of those people had more time even than prisoners who had killed somebody or committed acts of violence.
No, actually, all of that. Thank you so much for sharing, because what you were saying is, like, you know, and I do, I really empathize with the fact that you've had to go to you were in prison for 16 years for something you were wrongfully accused of. Now you have so much compassion, it seems, across the board. Now there are people who really did commit the crimes, and I'm pretty sure people have asked you, well, maybe you, Jeff, I should say, you deserve the compassion, but what about the other people? You know, like if they killed other people, they deserve, you know, they deserve to go through that type of punishment. How do you see it across the board of just human compassion from that perspective? Do you really feel that when entering into the system, that even just the loss of freedom dramatically changes you? Have you seen that in even people who were convicted? Can you?
Yes. Yeah, I've seen how, yes. All right. So my answer to that is, again, firstly, I'm not advocating for people to get away with crimes. Okay. So we're not saying that they shouldn't be incarcerated or that they shouldn't be sentenced, that they shouldn't serve a punishment. What we're saying is that what I'm saying is that while they are incarcerated, they should not be mistreated, that all these things that I mentioned should not be allowed to go on, because that's the opposite of rehabilitation. If you don't put a humane environment together, then rehabilitation that takes place is going to be despite the system instead of because of the system. So that would be what I would say. And I would also say someone's done 10 years or 20 years. I mean, they've done their time already. There's a such thing as aging out of crime. When people are younger, they don't have the same perspective. They're more susceptible to poor choices and peer pressure and spontaneity. They don't think about the consequence. So, I mean, I'm not the same person I was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. So if somebody has earned that second chance because they did their time, and when they go to parole board, you could see that they're changed, that they're different, that they did educational programs, that they stayed out of trouble, that they took programs addressing the crime that they're incarcerated for, then at that point, they should be released.
Yes.
That would be my argument.
Yeah, you know? No, and it totally makes sense, because I mean, it's hard when you're talking about, you know, murder cases and taking other people's lives, and people have such just a hard view of it, right? But what you're saying is that's what the system is truly built for, is really reform. And like you were saying, you for 16 years had actually seen it. And for someone, like I said, for what you were accused of and not having, you know, done that, I can only imagine what 16 years does to you, right? Because even in the documentary, you're even saying that sometimes it wasn't even worth, putting on the handcuffs in order to be outside. And those are freedoms I was just thinking about it. Those are freedoms we completely just take for granted.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, I agree with that. So you're really talking about when I was the one time I went to solitary confinement, and how, you know, every time you leave the cell, they put you in handcuffs, and you know, they put you in a small area that you can't see the sky. There's the clock. There's no clock. The lights are on all the time. You have no idea of what time it is. You only would know that if there's breakfast items served on the tray. You know, very little property. Your cosmetics are kept in a box with your name on it, so you don't have access to that on a daily basis. You know, you take a limited number of showers each week. I mean, all of these things. I mean, that's not a legitimate part of security. That's not a legitimate part of running the prison system.
No, okay. Could I, you know, if you're open to like all these questions, and you said that
I am. I'm open to everything. Listen, any of the stuff I'm saying, if you want to push back, if you want to give a different opinion, if you want to play devil's advocate, we can discuss all of that. I'm prepared to do that. That's fine.
I'm just, okay. So for someone like, you know, Jeff, for someone who is very, especially if you're wrongfully convicted, wouldn't be a violent person. You mentioned this in the documentary. Does everyone have to go through periods of solitary confinement?
No, they don't. What I went through a period of solitary confinement, which was 28 days, because I was defending myself against other prisoners that were coming to stab me. Because in their mind, they thought that I was a rapist. And there's a vigilante mentality towards people who were convicted of sex offenses. So I didn't wait for them to come and stab me. You know, I might have lost my life. So I took the battle to them and I did the best that I could. You know, I'm really not a fighter. I'm not a violent person, but I'm not going to sit back and let you come and kill me either. So I'm going to do the best that I can. And, you know, and that landed me in solitary confinement. I almost lost my life, first of all. I got hit multiple times on the side of my head with a 10-pound weight plate. And I also got sent to the solitary confinement on top of that. So that's why that was me. But there are other people, like I've seen, like people, some were sent to solitary 90 days, 6 months, a year, 2 years for smoking marijuana. Now, I'm not advocating anyone should be allowed to smoke marijuana, but that's an addiction. That's a drug problem. Do we want to put solitary confinement for 6 months or a year or 2 years? That's the answer to that. Do you think that that's going to legitimately address any addiction or address the habit of marijuana?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Gosh, you're just bringing so much to light right now, because even in the short documentary, you didn't even, you know, list that, you know, or even talk about the solitary confinement. You did talk about how, like, you have to be in there and you have to defend yourself. And so, for me, it brings up the question, well, if everyone has committed a crime in there, why do they go after certain people like yourself? Or is it because inside the system, do they see certain things as like different offenses with everyone else? Like there's things that you can't, you know, like I said, for you, it was rape and murder, supposedly, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, right. It was a charge. Yeah.
It was charged. So, obviously there's apparently a system that goes inside where they know what each of you have gone in there for. And so did they see that with you because it was rape and murder of.
Right. Yeah. A 15 year old girl, a classmate. Yes. The prisoners can discover what you're incarcerated for. That's not that hard to do. I mean, first of all, the Department of Corrections has a website. So if I'm a prisoner and I want to be nosy about what the next prisoner's in there for, I could just give their name and ask somebody on the outside to go on the internet and look it up for me. So that would be one way. Another way would be I could just go down to the law library, and if I know how to do legal research, I could pull somebody's case and discover what they were incarcerated for. You know, so sometimes the guards go out of their way to discover what, you know, to learn what someone's incarcerated for, and they can tell the other prisoners. Sometimes that happens too. But of course, when they do that, you know, they're doing that hoping that something would happen to you. So those are some of the ways that it could be discovered what you're incarcerated for, you know. But to answer your other part of your question, though, you know, as part of the prison culture, you know, this vigilante mentality towards people who are convicted of sex offenses, you know, and that mentality is an unflinching thing that doesn't really take into account the reality that wrongful convictions could happen even in a sex offense case is number one. But in number two, even if it's not a wrongful conviction, the person is incarcerated is there because they've been found guilty and they've already been sentenced. It's not up to another prisoner to decide to try to mete justice out. That's not their role. Because as far as I'm concerned, nobody is there for doing something good. You either did something bad or they convicted you of it. At a minimum, they convicted you of it. So in either case, you're really not in position to me. You know, if you live in a glass house, don't throw stones.
Yeah, absolutely. I share the same view because I was like, everyone's in there for a reason, you know, whether they've actually committed the crime or not. And then I was just like, they're just taking justice into their own hands. And, you know, it's such a harsh look into really what the system is really like. But we need these platforms such as the 8 billion or all these other podcasts to get it out there for true reform of people, because it is such it's a system that really needs to be corrected. And in the 16 years that you were there, there wasn't, I'm assuming, has there been some improvement since the time that you've been released? Are there other, I mean, does that lead to the asking you about the recharge beyond the bars reentry program?
Yeah. Well, you could ask me next that. Yeah. So, but I wouldn't say that the system is really, getting better. I mean, maybe what's better now is people are talking now more about mass incarceration and, you know, the problems on parole and prisoner reentry. So there's some talk now about that. And, you know, groups and individuals are working towards trying to change the system. But in terms of the system itself, embracing that and doing something about it, I would say that no, that it's still not any better now. Recharge Beyond the Bars Reentry Game is a game that I co-own with Leslie Robinson, who's a therapist. She came up with the game, and I decided to invest in the game because I believed in the product. So when I was released, I found it very difficult to communicate with family and old friends and new people when I knew that they had not been incarcerated. So they didn't know what it was like to go on trial or to be in prison or to experience the difficulties of reentry. And I remember my brother said to me once, he said, "I don't know what to say. I don't know what not to say. I don't know what to ask. I don't know what not to ask." So Recharge steps in the middle and removes that awkwardness through icebreaker questions. Because you know, community and being able to express yourself is very important, and it's healing as well. So that's what Recharge is about, and that's why I got involved in it. And you know, let me just quickly build off of another point, tie in into what we've talked about so far is, you know, there have been prisoners who have been released who did their time for crimes they absolutely did do, and now they're contributing meaningfully to society. Some are working in nonprofit organizations, some work with the homeless, others are able to help divert at-risk youth from following in their footsteps and ultimately ending up into prison, and some teach and some do justice reform advocacy work. And so when we don't release people that have earned a second chance, then as a society, we're losing out on that. But as is mm-hmm. their family, as it, you know, and that's, but also as is their family. I mean, it's much better to be in a two-parent household than a single. So when somebody's time is finished and, you know, they've earned it. Again, you hear I'm saying earned, not that it's their right.
Yeah,
I'm saying
absolutely.
It's earned. Then when the time is up, they should be released and not held and, you know, continuing this cycle. So.
Wow. No, it's just, I mean, there's so much to like cover. You definitely have lived an amazing life. I mean, again, 16 years in prison, right? And then yes. When you come out of it, and like what you said, even just touching on the fact that, you know, even the college system works, because I was like, how did you, you know, when I was doing all this research on you, on your story, I was like, how did he complete a bachelor's degree? Then you went on to do a master's degree in criminal justice and then went to law school. All also at the same time becoming, you know, an doing advocacy yes. for all of this. That is just an incredible life that you live. So, I mean, you know, even just being, going through everything that you did, you know, let me ask you, Jeff, when you were in prison and, you know, there were times when you talked about this in the documentary where you said that you had even, because of the relationship that you had even with your family, that you had even reached out outside of your family to just maybe even have a pen pal or someone right. to communicate with. You know, that's, I mean, just even the simple human communication was just something that is even a disparity even in the prison system, right? I mean,
yes.
Like, could you take me, you know, through that time in your life where it just, like, it's amazing what the human spirit can do if it just continues to stay alive. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. Yes. Yeah. So, you know, so in New York State, the prison system, they're in the habit of housing prisoners that are from the city. They're put in the country part of the state, you know, like the more like in upstate. So people from the city are put upstate and people who are upstate are put in the city. And to me, that's kind of backwards because, you know, It's family ties, community ties are definitely a factor when people are able to transition back to a successful transition to society, a crime-free life. Having community ties is important. So why would you not want to put people in prison in a facility that's as near to their home as you can, so that you could encourage family contact Absolutely. Rather than discourage it. Right. So I was put in Elmira, which was about 4.5 hours away from my home. So starting out, my mother was my only consistent visitor. She would come a couple times a month, make the 4.5 hour trip each way. My grandmother used to come with her. My grandmother passed away after about 5 or 6 years. My brother's 3.5 years younger than me, and he came to see me 3 times in 16 years, not at all in the last decade. Now, in the last 5 or 6 years, I would be, you know, the long trip wore on my mother, and things tightened up some financially, and she experienced a few health problems as far as, you know, her back and her feet. And so now, all those factors, I was lucky if I saw her once every 5 or 6 months. You know, the last 5 or 6 years, I had a couple sets of aunts and uncles. They'd come and visit, disappear for 3 years, come and visit, disappear for 3 years. You know, so though not literally, I mostly did the time by myself. Okay. So hence the need for placing an ad for a pen pal. So I did that in what turned out to be my last couple of years. Cause I mean, I was basically at the end of my rope, you know, I really couldn't keep going anymore as far as continuing to be incarcerated, because I had lost 7 appeals. I mean, that was 11 years. I wrote letters for 4 years to looking for someone to help me, just looking for legal help and really getting responses. So, you know, my thought was, let me place an ad. I need some outside contact. So let me just place an ad. And other prisoners did that too. You know, would place an ad and look for a pen pal. And maybe at some point the conversation would evolve and it would eventually work its way around to, what are you doing in there? And that would be my chance to explain I'm innocent, explain about my case, send some documents. And look, if they believe me, maybe they can help build that bridge between me and the necessary legal help that I needed. So with that in mind, I did place an ad. I mentioned I was innocent, the DNA, and somebody did answer. This guy named Scott, he did answer. And the last couple of years, I had that pen pal with him because I needed that contact from the outside. And I was openly asking the stranger, who I had no pre-existing relationship with, I was asking him, should I quit? Should I just give up? Maybe I should just commit suicide and be done. I'm never going to make it out of here, you know. And he encouraged me to keep going. And so that was a big part of how I survived the last couple of years. But on that topic, in terms of how I survived overall, so in my mind, I kind of lived from appeal to appeal. You know, I didn't focus on a 15 to life sentence. I just thought, you know, if I can just hold on for a year or two until the next appeal would be decided, you know, I'm sure I'm going to win the case and go home because I'm innocent. So that was one aspect of it. Another aspect, belief in God was part of it. Another thing was, I used to go to the law library and learn the law, and that gave a sense of comfort. And I used to collect articles about other people who were exonerated, and that helped me motivation wise. And I would study, like, you know, who helped them and what route did they take? And then aside from that, I from 1998 to 2006, I read 3 or 4 nonfiction books a week, and I oriented the program, whatever I could take to learn in the prison that had some kind of potential use or benefit for me. Then I took it. I didn't waste my time. I got a GED. I did the associates. I did towards the bachelor's before it was cut. I learned the type, which helps me a lot right now on the computer. I took computer repair. I did general business, which pertains to various applications of the computer in a workforce setting. I took a class on how adults learn and worked as a teacher's aide, helping people to get the GED. So I did all these things. I mean, even I had elaborate delusion. So whenever I would play basketball or chess or ping pong, I sometimes pretended like if I was a professional player, and so was the other people. But just, it wasn't like kids having fun on the playground. This was, I needed to get out of the prison for a couple of hours mentally. And I would listen to sports talk radio, but it's not sports talk radio. It was a lifeline to the outside. And maybe the last thing I'll mention in rounding out that answer is that there was another prisoner there who was wrongfully imprisoned also. And his name was Frank Sterling. And we used to, you know, I don't need to make it more than what it was. We used to get together once every 6 weeks, and we would try to keep each other going morale wise. And we would kind of brainstorm about what was the next move that we could make in order to try to overturn the conviction and regain our freedom. And so that helped me keep going too. And, you know, Frank was proven innocent through DNA testing a couple of years after me. So it wasn't just that he claimed that he was innocent. He actually was. We both actually were.
Wow. That's amazing. Even what you did, like in just to fill your time, and for obvious reasons, God had different plans for you. You know what I mean? Like, yes. And then it's, so at which point though, I want to say, because I know what you were saying is you connected with the outside world and you did, you know, you, of course you had to go through the formalities of getting to know each other. And then you're even trying to say, well, I'm wrongfully convicted and here's my DNA. I mean, that still takes time for that exchange to happen, right? Yes. Going back, when did you find out though, just for the audience, when did the DNA come out that you were innocent, or that it proved that you weren't the one that had raped and killed the victim?
So the results of the DNA was known at the before the trial started, you know. That was my, you know, but I, the prosecutor got the medical examiner to commit fraud and claim, oh, he forgot to document medical evidence that he said showed the victim was promiscuous, you know. So that was why the DNA didn't match me. That, you know, not that I was innocent, but that she slept with somebody else. So they made, he made that up. And then he made up, he claimed, you know, who it was that he said slept with the victim, but he never got a DNA test to prove that. He didn't even call him as a witness. He just made an unsupported argument to the jury. So that was when the DNA originally didn't match me. But in answer to the question of how was I proven innocent through the DNA? Okay. The answer is that the DNA technology advanced, and so the DNA data bank had been created. So when I was able to get further DNA testing, which, you know, again, it was at the end of the 16 years that I did, they took that DNA evidence, which already didn't match me, and they entered it into the data bank, and it matched the actual perpetrator's DNA, because left free while I was doing time for his crime, he killed a second victim who was a school teacher and had two children. Now, so my conviction was overturned based on the DNA data bank results. And he confessed. Wow. Also. And then I went back to court November 2nd, 2006. All the charges against me were dismissed on actual innocence grounds. And he was arrested and convicted of the crime.
So Jeff, the advancement in the DNA bank, if he didn't commit the second crime,
I would still be there.
You would still be there. And in the oddest way, it was almost just time that needed to happen in order for all of this to.
I agree. Yeah, you're right.
Right. If you just think about it from a full, it was just time that would, but he had to have committed that second crime, and the advancement of the DNA bank had to have happened.
Yes. No, 100%. Yeah, you're right. So, I mean, getting representation from Innocence Project, that was the key. The second thing is the district attorney who had fought all of my appeals and stopped me from getting the testing. She left office. And her successor allowed me to get the testing. And then the third thing, which we've just mentioned, was the results matched him. So, yeah, you're right.
Oh, my goodness. Just this story just continues to keep amazing me, only because One, I get to, of course, I read, you know, I've watched the documentary, then I've read about it. But to actually be here and be able to ask you these questions and the details of it are just amazing. It just almost leads me to this next question. And I'm just trying to keep, I keep toggling back and forth because these are the things that a lot of people are probably gonna ask. One thing that I did want to ask you, you know, the documentary is very short. Was there a reason why you kind of kept it short? Did you want to expand on it a little more? Is there going to be any plans of expanding on it to tell more of the story in length?
Sure. So firstly, just to be clear, I'm the subject of the documentary. I didn't make it. So that was produced and directed by Gia Wirtz, the filmmaker. And this was actually her first foray into making a documentary. Yeah. But that having been said, Gia's strategy in deciding to just make it shorter is, first of all, it was a lot less money. And secondly, her other thought was, if the documentary did well, which it has. So the documentary has been accepted into 12 different film festivals. It's won 3 awards. So it won Best Documentary, Best Cinematography, and Award of Distinction. So her thought was, if it does well, then that's kind of like a proof of concept, which would facilitate her getting more funds to make the bigger piece. And so there is plans to have a bigger documentary that would be about an hour and a half. And so that would get a little bit more into my case, the specifics of the case itself, and have voices other than my own. So like in the, a lot of the work is already done now since the documentary short's been released, you know, prior to the next part. So, you know, there'll be interviews, with my mother, with my best friend, with one of my best friends, another person, my lawyer, and then Maggie Taylor, who kept representing my case to the Innocence Project. And so you'll get the other people to round out everything. So one more thing I just wanted to add, that the other aspect of why the story was really more about my life post-exoneration and my advocacy work was Gia made the creative choice that she wanted to make this documentary different than many of the other documentaries that are out there about other exonerees. So in those other stories, those other documentaries by other producers, those are really heavy on the legal details on the case. And so she wanted to focus on something different in order to make it stand out.
Well, no, I'm glad that you brought that up, because that is what I really wanted to touch on, you know, especially like, let me ask you, you know, you went and talked about what your life was like after, you know, even just your dating life, you know, right. If you'd like to, you know, I've done multiple podcasts and we've gone into everything about relationships. I mean, if you don't mind talking about it, and I'm pretty sure you're fine with it because you've done the documentary. Could you elaborate on some of that? Because I'm thinking offhand, well, once you are exonerated and there's all this, it's not going to be, you know what I mean? It wouldn't be hard for you to have a dating life or, you know, start a family, but if you want to talk on that first, and touch on other questions.
Yeah. I'll touch on that first. All right. So I understand what you're saying and what you're asking. And yeah, you might think that true, but that's on the surface of it. But that's why we're doing this interview and we're getting into it. So here's how it works. So here's the challenges on that. So first of all, remember that I was incarcerated from age 17 to 32. So approach dynamics in different settings. So I never actually learned that, you know. So there's that's a challenge. Another aspect of it is, you know, remember I was incarcerated for a rape with a murder. So in the back of my mind, you know, at times I haven't been quite as assertive or maybe as bold as I perhaps should have if I was attracted to somebody, because in the back of my mind, you know, I was worried. I don't want somebody to say, well, he made me feel uncomfortable. So that's an aspect of it. But then another aspect of it you know, is that, you know, there is a stigma as a result of having been incarcerated. Yeah, you were in prison wrongfully for 16 years, yes. But you were there for 16 years, though. So how much of that rubbed off on you? Is it, you know, safe to be alone someplace with you?
Yeah.
So that has proven to have been a challenge. I mean, I remember one time I, you know, briefly was seeing somebody who was a psychologist, and she was like, look, I understand what the after effects are of your experience. And, you know, I already deal with that in my day job. I can't then come home to that. So it's a little bit much. So I'm just giving that as an example of, you know, it's perceived sometimes that maybe there's a little too much baggage. So that's kind of a challenge also. And even in just having somewhat of a disconnect between my physical age and appearance versus mental state and emotional intelligence. So what I mean by that, to put some color on that, and this was actually the headline of an article in New York Times, by the way, a reporter picked up on it. You know, I was released when I was 32, but feeling like I'm 17. So there's that kind of a challenge. So that's been some of the challenges. But another thing, you know, in thinking about women that are, you know, in my age bracket, so you want to be liberal about that and say plus or minus 10 years, right? I mean, I'm 47 now. So keeping that plus or minus 10 around, you know, what I found is, I mean, a lot at that point, I mean, they're hearing their biological clock ticking. So if they're thinking about having kids, it's got to happen like really soon, you know, and, you know, they're looking to have something really serious, like immediately, rather than just have things develop organically over time as they happen. But I'm in a different place, you know, so for someone to have patience and to just move along slow as things develop, you know, that's been some of the challenge. I mean, I've had people just ask me when they've met me, what are you looking for? Or are you ready to be serious? And I'm like, well, I'm just like met you. How can I can say that? I have to see what develops, how I feel, how you feel. How do all these things that I can't predict are going to turn out happen? And we go from there. But they were more like in a push forward. I have to hurry up and make this thing happen. You know, so that's another aspect. That's another aspect to it.
No, but you know, I completely understand what you're saying. You know, because me too. I'm 40. I'm 43. I already have a son, right? So I'm in a different position. But I understand exactly what you're talking about. Being as a woman, especially when they hit their 30s, I have girlfriends that are in their early 30s, and that's the topic of, you know, once they start dating is like, oh, do you want to have kids? Because they want to feel like at the same time that they're investing in something that'll take them to that place. But at the same time though, too, you're talking to a guy who's just like, I just want to go on a few dates. I just want to, you know, I want to just experience what life is, you know, like just being in your presence. So I get that disparity between men and women sometimes. So I understand that. But another thing that really called out to me too in the documentary is what you were saying, like the simple things that what we got to do when in our teenage years and probably early 20s is get to go and party. You know what I mean? And drink and do all kinds of stuff. You didn't necessarily get to do that. I do hope though that you've, at least from the time that you were released at 32 all the way to maybe now, you've had a few experiences, right? But
yes,
I would just say, Jeff, I encourage you honestly with what's happened in especially your life and what's happened all around the world in the pandemic. I know the world is starting to open up, but what I always encourage people to do is just really live from that space of true joy. I mean, if it makes you happy to party all night at like, you know, at whatever age, as long as you're doing it responsibly and you're not hurting other people, you could do it at any age. You know?
Yeah, I agree with you. Look, so if the choice is better late than never, so you know, if it's to either do it, you know, later in life or not at all, you know, I think it's better to experience something belatedly than it is, you know, than it is not, you know, not at all.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, but definitely I completely get what you're saying as far as, you know, just being responsible and not hurting people's feelings. I mean, you know, while I do feel younger than my age, at other times I feel like I'm older than my age also. Like I understand that to be mature and, you know, what can actually go wrong, how a small thing could lead into some kind of really big thing, you know, so I'm well aware of, you know, and so I'm aware of that. And, you know, maybe one more thing I'll mention on this topic, and you know, that I really haven't actually shared anywhere. I mean, I remember one time there was a woman, and I went out with her a few times, and you know, like she was from another state, and she flew to see me, and maybe over the course of 4 months, you know, we saw each other maybe like 10 or 11 days in person, and we used to talk on the phone, and it was time for her to leave and go back home, and like, she basically wanted to leave her life behind. She wanted to quit her job, leave her house behind, and just like marry me and stay, you know, and live with me. And I already explained long ago, listen, just, we have to go slow. I don't know what I'm going to think 1 minute to the next, 1 hour to the next. So, you know, if you can just relax and see how things go, that's fine. But, you know, like, if you're looking for something super serious, like immediately, then, you know, that's not me. Right. So, but she was cool with that, but it's time for her to go. And she mentioned all that stuff to me, and she wanted me to like marry her within like 4 months. And when I couldn't say yes, as I'm driving her to the airport for her to go back home, because it's time for her to go back home, like she cried in the car the whole way. And I felt this small. You know, I felt this small because I felt like I just made you like upset. But the only way to stop you from crying, for you not to be upset, is to agree to marry you. And I can't do that. Yeah. So, yes.
Wow. No, thank you for sharing that. I mean, we've covered so many topics. And I mean, honestly, Jeff, you're such a just amazing human being. On top of, you know, you're an exceptional attorney and the path that you live. To me, the topic of this whole podcast is, oh, you know, it is always about people finding their passions and, you know, they're living out their mission, being on mission and living out their true purpose. And you're doing that. And of course, only time would just reveal that. Even me stepping into my 40s and really living more purposefully and on mission now, it just seems so clear to me. But yet I feel like for many years of my life, I was like, well, why can't I get it together in my 20s or 30s? But everything truly is just divine timing. It's God's timing. It's the way like the story has to unfold for your life, for things to start to change. But it really is just about the human spirit. I mean, you know, to the audience, if you know you were incarcerated for 16 years on a wrongful conviction, can you only just imagine what life would be like to try and get back into society, or how you'd feel like I spent 16 years in prison for something I didn't do? But it's amazing, like I said, what the human spirit can do, and it's just those little things to do to like keep focused on you know, moving forward. You would know that, Jeff, of all, you know, of all people.
Yeah, 100%, definitely. So to build off of your prompt there. So, you know, clearly, like I said, my mission is, you know, definitely to free other people in the same position I was, to do some work on the preventative side, the other justice reform issues. And I find meaning in that. It's healing. It's cathartic. You know, I know who I am and what my purpose in the world is, and that allows me to have some inner peace. Definitely not an angry person, because I want to enjoy my life as much as I can, and I can't do that if I'm angry or bitter. I have lost so much already as is. Why would I want to, in effect, lose the rest of my life, which is what would happen? And if I was angry or bitter, and really in that scenario, I would be the only loser in that. It's not like I would be impacting the people that had a hand in what happened to me. And so the vehicle that allows me to actualize that is I take the energy that I feel and I channel it into the advocacy work.
Yeah.
That I do. But if I was to look back on, you know, what can be extrapolated from my life and from my journey, you know, I would share with the audience this, that really the formula just for overcoming adversity, extreme adversity, something small, and everything in between. So have a goal, have a realistic plan. You should be able to look at your plan and see it from three or four different directions that you could see how it could possibly work. So goal, plan, be flexible. Remember, the goal is the goal. The plan's not the goal. The plan is just how to get there. So if you need to make an adjustment, if a door or opportunity opens up for you en route that still works towards your goal, just in a different way, then you'd be flexible. No reasons why you can't accomplish something. Only reasons why something might be more difficult. Work hard and never give up. And when you feel like you're going to give up, you know, and I do, I've done this myself, and I say this to myself when I'm about to give up on something, I say, you know, maybe this is the key moment. Maybe I was on the verge of a breakthrough, but because I gave up, then it's not going to happen. So even though I can't continue anymore, I'm going to do it anyway, just to see what happens on the other side. And then once you've overcome, you reach back and you help someone else in the same position and do some work on the preventative side to prevent other people from experiencing what you did. And if you can do that, then you can take some meaning out of what happened. It would be healing, cathartic. You can have some inner peace. You'd be making the world, you know, a better place. And I know that that message, that formula, and that reaching back and prevention that I spoke about, that goes far beyond wrongful conviction or justice reform. I think that that applies to somebody that, say, has had some debilitating illness, or, you know, maybe they're a domestic abuse survivor, or maybe they've survived a sexual assault, or maybe they've been homeless, or maybe they've experienced, racism or discrimination or anything else, something small, something big, you know, apply that formula to any of those walks of life, any of those scenarios.
No, that was an amazing message. Cause I was just going to say, Jeff, if you could leave the audience, if you could talk to if this became a time capsule and you could say anything to 8 billion people, is that it? That is the message that you would leave everyone, especially with your life experiences, right?
100%. Yes. And I also would encourage them, enjoy the small things. So I like feeling the fresh air. I like feeling the sun on my face, freedom of movement. I think you can experience life through trying new things, having new experiences, sampling new food, going to new places, you know, travel. So you can experience the world in those things, and that it's absolutely better to chase dreams, you know, even and try to turn them to reality. Even if in the end you ultimately don't accomplish them, it's still better to do that and try instead of never trying at all and always wondering, you know, what could have happened.
No, absolutely. I mean, I've had moments where I cry, I cried, but this one is very meaningful for me, Jeff, just because, I have the utmost respect for you on the journey that you've been on. And like what you were saying, even like the simplest things, because I remember when my mom was dying of cancer and it was like one of her last few days, they said, you know, there's nothing I could have done anymore to like extend her life, but they're like, could you just take her out so she could just feel the sunshine on her face? And that's some things that, you know, like it's given to us so freely for many of us, and for others, they don't get that. So I am going to go out after this and enjoy the sunshine on my face. But, you know, Jeff, if there's anyone that would there's anyone that would like to either reach out to you or how could they help with the foundation for all the work that you've done already, if they'd like to support you, what's the best way to get a hold of you? And if you could please expand on the foundation as well, if you'd like to share on that.
I definitely would, yes. So we have been able to free 11 wrongfully convicted people, and we helped to pass three laws. And then as with a bigger coalition, it could happen to you, which I'm an advisory board member of, which my foundation is part of. We've been able to pass five additional laws. We currently have 10 active cases, and we're pursuing policy changes in New York, Pennsylvania, and California. In terms of how people can reach me, there's definitely my website, www.deskovic.org. That's D-E-S-K-O-V-I-C. I have a public figure page on Facebook. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm also on Instagram. In terms of how people could assist, there is a crowdfunding site on the website, Patreon. So you could put in Google Patreon, Deskovic. So my dream is, you know, what if there were 25,000 people that were willing to help to free, wrongfully convicted people, if they agreed to be recurring monthly donors, say at a $3 level, $5 level, whatever level they could, you know, that would give us quite a large budget with which to be able to, you know, hire additional personnel, attorneys, investigators, paralegals, other essential personnel, so that we could work on more cases and we can expand our policy work into additional states. There is the Amazon Smile program. So if you shop on Amazon and you register the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation there as your charity of choice, and Amazon would donate a small percentage of your purchase without it increasing the price on the consumer. So those are all different ways people can assist the foundation, or, you know, maybe someone you know has a podcast, a blog, a Block Talk Radio, or other you know, medium to get the story out there. I mean, certainly just there, that would be a way people could help. Some corporations, they do corporate philanthropy. So mentioning the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation as a candidate to be considered, that could certainly help as well.
No, well, thank you so much. I will list all of that in the description box when this is on YouTube, as well as on the podcast. But Jeff, I just want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart for sharing this space with me, sharing the story. I know I went all over the place, but like I said, you know, I'd invite you to come back if you'd like to expand on it, or like the resources that I have with, like, if you're going to expand on the documentary, I'd love to, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Assist in any way that I can. I do have friends that are filmmakers and all this kind of stuff. And I definitely believe your story needs to come out, not only even just in the legal aspect of it, but also like what you're saying post, you know, like what post life is like for many, you know, for many of the people that have gone out of, you know, like prison or, you know, so it's all.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I just want to say thank you again. And thank you everyone who has tuned into this episode of the 8 Billion Podcast. And we look forward to having you on the next.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. If it's moved you in any way, please review and share your thoughts, or text me your thoughts at 949-247-2800.